Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
I am your host, Tanya Communication Doctor, and the reason I do this show is because I want to provide a space for people to speak their authentic truth, coming from a heart space rather than a head space. Allow people to get into their space of consciousness, their space of confidence, and their space of connection. This, I think, promotes positive mental health, and this is why I do what I do. Hello, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Tanya the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have author and entrepreneur, Stephen Graham. Welcome, Stephen. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Yourself?
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. We're lucky today. The sun is shining and I'm recording this in September. So it's a beautiful day. It will be coming out a little bit later, but it's just really, really lovely to be here and to have some sun finally in England, because for all my American listeners and people everywhere else in the world, we've had really bad weather during the summer. So now finally the sun is shining and we've been predicted a heat wave this week. So it should be good. So I'm going to go straight in. I'm going to dive straight in, because the reason I've got Stephen on my show is because I felt that Stephen's journey has been very interesting in terms of his story. His story is just very, 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 very powerful. And he's written a book, and the book is called Incarceration, J.A., and it's a self-reflective analysis of his life. Could you start by just telling me, number one, a little bit about what the book's about and why you wrote the book?
The book's about my personal experiences and what I've been through as a youth growing up. We live in society, we live in a very traumatic society, and everyone has their individual traumas that they go through. Mine is very extensive in regards to a lot of things I've been through, my family life, and things that happen that happens for a lot of young people in a lot of ways. You know, my traumas that I've been through, the neglect of a father not in my life, you know, not having the best stepfather in my life, and, you know, just experiencing a lot of neglect and things that will, you know, that where it doesn't allow you to actually see and acknowledge the best of my self-worth as a youth, while all the things I went through. So I end up, you know, doing time in jail and just had a lot of negative effects from situations that went on as a youth. And of course, like ripple effects of things that I went through spilled out into my actions. And so then, yeah, it caused me to write the book, because after spending so much years in prison, I've seen a lot of young people going through the same similar situations today, you know, when I'm caught up in life on the streets. And, you know, like I said, everyone's got their own traumas. I thought that I just wanted to reach out to not just the young people, but also the parents as well, for them to understand and get a bigger picture of what goes on psychologically in a young person's mind when they're going through things. Even like a lot of adults live with unresolved issues and unresolved traumas that they ain't dealt with themselves, you know. So my book is really just tailored to kind of touch hearts and souls. You get what I mean? It's written from my heart and from my soul to touch other hearts and soul, you know. So
That's brilliant. And just in that short space of time, you touched on so many things just there. First of all, with regards to like the psychological effects that it can have on you, that they had on you, and also that it has on young people when you do go through what you go through, with number one, you mentioned absent father. Also, you mentioned the fact that, you know, you'd been in jail. So I want to talk about that, because there's so many different layers there. And you're so right when you said a lot of people, a lot of adults have unresolved issues. And you know what? I think most people have unresolved issues, if I'm honest with you. That's what I feel. Just from doing the work that I do, I kind of get that, really. Before, we used to put people in a bracket with regards to mental health. But yeah, I think everybody has mental health, and we need to have a look at the difference between mental health and mental illness, because I think everyone in some point of their lives goes through something, and there's just different levels as to what that person goes through. And you mentioned the fact that, you know, you're helping young people, you're supporting young people now, because maybe you're the person that understands them if they're going through something similar to what you're going through. And it's nice to have that person or that mentor that can help them and really get them and really understand what they're going through. So let's go. I'm going to go a little bit back, okay, because I want to kind of, I'm going to go a little bit of a journey through your life in Real Stories today, and I want to start with your childhood. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you to pick an age that you were most happiest in your childhood, first of all, and talk to me about it, because I think it's always nice to start with a little bit of joy. So pick an age. It could be, I don't know, could be 8, for example. It could be whatever you like, 8, 10, whatever, a time that you were most happy. And it could be something really simple, and just describe that so I get a little bit of a sense of your personality.
6, 7, I was really happy at 6, 7. Outside, I remember him clearly. I used to play football a lot. I love football. I was really good at football. I used to play football on the mound with my friends, and you know, we'd play against the other side of our area. So we had the front street and the back street. We'd play against each other. It was really fun those times. And then we used to collect football magazines and just football stickers. Then tied the football magazines and your stickers. I used to like football. I used to like Chelsea. Not Chelsea. Queens Park Rangers and Liverpool. At the time, you had like Ian Rush and Kenny Dalglish and all these players back in the day. Jan Moore before Liverpool. And we used to get the little stickers that you buy from the shops and try to fill your football magazine, you know, and you buy stickers and stick them into your magazine. Like, those are the good days. Those are good days. That's the days that really, I can feel like I put a smile on my face. I think about my football days. It was really fun. You know, it was enjoyable. I was young and I used to love it. Like, I still love football. But that's what was my days of really, really nice days, I say. When I got a bit older, to 8, then things have changed.
Yeah, and that was my next question. So I was going to, and that's lovely to hear your enthusiasm about football, because you lit up, your face just lit up when you mentioned that. You're like, I could never put the stickers in.
I'm a bad boy. Football was something I really loved, you know. It was something I really loved. And I always encourage, before we even go further, I would encourage parents today that when your child is passionate about something, they should always push your child's passion. A lot of us push education more than passion. Yes. And we don't realize how important it is to actually follow your child's passion, because when you follow your child's passion, you actually will allow that child to be the best they can be, and it will actually filter into their education. Because if a child's happy doing, whether it's football, basketball, violin, piano, whatever the child likes to do, if you push that child in their passion that they love, by the time, with their failing in their academics, that will change. That will funnel open to becoming much better at academics, because they're happy in what they're doing, and they see the reward of doing what they're passionate about. But a lot of us tend to society to push education, but I think it's just something that we need not to do so much, because that's a downfall I see of a lot of young kids, and it was a part of mine as well. You know, the education. No. It's not that parents are being bad or being negative, but we've got this mindset that, you know, education is so important. You know, it's so important to get a degree. When you look at this, when you look at perfection, it's really 360 degrees, and degrees are really nothing, because you're pushing too much information in my brain where they're not actually allowing me to bring out the best of me, which is what your passion is.
You know, that's so true, because, you know, education and say that kind of route of a degree is not for everyone. At the end of the day, it's not for everyone. And it's really interesting that you said that. And I always feel quite blessed myself, because I studied dance and drama. And my parents, I'm the youngest, because all my older sisters got it, where they had to study all the hardcore subjects. But then I got the opportunity to do what I wanted to do. But then it doesn't necessarily mean, looking back, that you can't do the academia later. Do you know, if you wanted to do something a little bit more hardcore later in life? And I think that's kind of been my journey. And it's just lovely what you just said, that, because I do. My son actually loves football. Do you know, absolutely loves it. And I can see it's his first love as well. And for me, it's just important that your children, or, you know, this next generation, do follow their passion, and we do feed that passion, because you never know what that's going to turn into. And that, and like, even if it doesn't end up being anything, and you've got memories, and it's just the way you just lit up talking about football, and that makes me feel like, yes, that's why it's important to feed that passion. Because just a moment ago, we're going to talk about your life, but when we went back to your happiest moment, football was clearly something that you loved, and your face just lit up. So that's a beautiful kind of picture. But coming back to that, we're going to go back and we're going to have a look at when it all changed. Yeah. So we started, you loved football. Mm-hmm. When did it change for you as a young person?
Actually, before I was 8, but it became really noticeable at 8. Mm. You know, my behavior, my attitude, and my behavior, the way my stepfather treated me, it became really noticeable to me. Like, it was clear that this guy never liked me. So that was had a big impact on my actions and the way I dealt with that. In junior school, I remember seeing this white lady, not knowing at that time she's a psychiatrist, because I was always angry and fighting and just sometimes I'll just, I was a smart guy, very smart, but I just would play the class clown and sometimes I'd be, there's a bit of a tension in it because like I'm not, my real dad's not around, my stepfather's not the best of stepfathers and I'm not really talkative. I was very introvert. So I wouldn't tell my mum that I felt too much about him of ways. So she never really understood what was going on in the beginning anyway herself. Do you get me? Didn't tell my brother and sisters neither because there's quite a lot of us. There's 7 of us. I kept a lot of things to myself, you know, so and that's the next thing I always tell young people when I talk to young people, try to stuff in silence. You know, find someone you believe you can talk to, you feel comfortable talking to. Because, you know, sometimes naming that, like, you know, you don't trust your parents or you don't trust your brothers or siblings, but not always talking your emotions is easy, you know. And I felt as a young person, I didn't know how to really talk, man. I was very introvert. I didn't know how to speak. But then that ended up coming out into my actions. So I was an introvert when I regards to my person, like how I was. In regards to my feelings, but in regards to when you're angry, you have to have your energy in it and you got to let it out somehow. Yes, so I became a mad extrovert in regards to violence. I would just let it out with violence on the streets.
Wow.
The way he would abuse me psychologically and physically beat me and tell me I did something, I didn't do it, and I wouldn't, you know, make a lot of noise saying I didn't do it. I just would take it, you know, and feel like he just hates me and he's blaming me for everything. I would then just react like that on the streets of people. You get me? So
wow, that's really interesting.
So technically, the abuser became an abuser. Like, yeah. I talk about in my book. In my book, which again, this is a cover of my book, Incarceration JA. I talk about in my book that the abuse, you know, it's a theory, until it's proven a fact.
Mm.
But in my case, it became a fact because I kind of mimicked his actions. So at school, in junior school, I would like hit a child and then say I didn't do it and then get away with it, you know? And then it's like, oh, I can do the same thing he does to me. And then I became that guy, you know, doing those kind of cunning stuff to other people. And then this went from one thing to the next thing, and it escalated to when I went to my first high school, I was booed out of that for violence. I was booed out for high schools, in fact.
Oh, wow, wow. So that's interesting that you've related that. So it's really, what's really interesting is you've actually identified that part of that was suppressed emotion, you know, because you were suppressing that emotion during your, you know, during your childhood. You said you weren't talking, so that your remote, it has to go somewhere, as you said, that energy. Because if you suppress it, it has to go somewhere. So it went in anger. And I think that's probably common for a lot of young boys generally, because, or men, I mean, would you say?
Parents are crab bills. I've seen, like, typically, parents crab bills, but the next minute they snap on you for something else, or they might snap on you for something else. You know, you see parents do it all the time. And I think you might see your friends' parents, your own parents. So I think it's a general thing that people do. You have energy, and the most powerful energies we have is, as we, with adult speak, we know, is sexual energy and anger. They make every strand of your hair in your body stand up. Do you get what I mean? It really brings every emotion to the forefront, sexual energy and anger. Those two energies are very powerful and potent. But if they're not, if anger is not challenged in the right way, it's going to be very destructive.
Yeah.
Do you get what I'm saying to you? Because it's a lot of energy. And sadly, like I said, I didn't really know how to channel mine. And again, being at school, I never learned how to deal with my emotions. I always talk about this to people. I talk about this in my book. I talk highly about this, where emotions isn't something we're taught in society how to deal with. Children, parents, we look at generational things going down. Parents don't know how to deal with their emotions themselves, because you see parents crying over bills. The kind of thing they cannot control. You know, you can't control a bill. You can't pay for that bill. You can't fix your car, or you can't get a new car. You need a car, but you're going to get mad over it and get angry over it. And you can't control that because you're not in the position to control it. But not in position to change, as I say, but because you can't change it, you want to get yourself upset and angry over it, which is kind of ludicrous. But society's made us feel like we have to have this and have to do that. But the reality is you can't change what's not in your power to change at that present time. So the best you can do is keep yourself calm and think of a solution how to deal with it.
Yeah.
But we're not really like that. Majority of us, we get frustrated when we can't do certain things because, again, society's made us to feel like, you know, you're less than if you don't do, or you're less than, and really and truly, everyone needs material to a certain level, but material can't align you mentally, emotionally. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Spiritually align yourself, you don't need material. To emotionally and mentally align yourself, you don't need material, you need self.
That's so true, Steph. And you've covered so much there in terms of, I just want to go a little bit deeper into with what you're saying there. So I just want to pull back a little bit, because there's so much in what you're saying with regards to, you know, what you've experienced and what young people experience every day in terms of how we use this energy and how we disperse this energy and the whole fact with regards. So you mentioned emotions there, because nobody, I think, in society generally, I think this could be a class thing as well. We're not taught how to deal with our emotions. And because you think about maybe the middle class, say a middle class white person, I'm just using this as an example, they might see a psychologist from a young age if they identify something's wrong. But us young, if you're coming from a black community, a totally different demographic, you're not going to always have that opportunity to look at that. So, I mean, let's have a look at race here in terms of, let's go a little bit deeper. You're as a young black man, you know, you're working with young people, suppressed emotions. Let's talk a little bit about that in terms of what we can do as a community to support our young people. As you said, sometimes we're suppressed ourselves. You've got black mothers, you've got single black mothers who can be suppressing their emotions. And as you said, don't know how to deal with their emotions and then are kind of releasing all of this energy, which is negative energy. And then their children sometimes will have some of this negative energy. And it just goes on and on because we model our behavior. Yeah, our children model our behavior. So the behavior that we put out as a parent is, you know, subconsciously what our children are modeling. So it can be negative and it be positive, but we're not, nobody's perfect. You know, nobody's perfect.
To add to that, to go a little deeper, it's even more than the parents themselves. Mm. Society plays a massive role in how your children grow.
Yes, and of course.
That's why we watch things called programs. Mm. It literally does program you. And yeah, we have to understand the powers of media. So society plays a massive key role because I know quite a few children have good mothers, whether single mothers or even, you know, mom and father in the home. But society, how the projection of society outside that they're engaging. Remember, a child's outside on the road much more than in their house, especially they're going to college.
Because,
and your influence of music and your influence of so many different things. There's so many energies. We're talking about low-level vibration, high-level vibration. You know, we're talking about so many different vibrations affecting you spiritually, mentally, emotionally, in society. So it's more just even just appearance than what's even going on. That plays a massive role. But, you know, we live in, to me, the two biggest theories, like I talk about in my book, is conditioning theory and learning theory. And these are two theory models that a lot of people don't realize how potent they are in our lives because we're conditioned to do certain things and to act a certain way. And then again, you got learning theory as well, which again, a lot of things you see, even like in the, like even the same traumas we have here that's going on in London, Scotland had a similar situation.
Of course.
Scotland had more stabbings than even we had in London.
Yeah.
At the same time, Scotland did approach, total 360 degree approach on how they dealt with their poverty and how they dealt with the people who see young people like teachers and nurses who actually first to like stabbings when kids come into hospitals because nurses first see you, how they approach that. Now I feel like, again, it's they've been trained to, there'd be a lot of training to help Scotland. London should take that same leaf out of this book and do the same thing for the youth in London.
Yeah.
You know, black, white, for all the young kids. But it's not just going to happen from a systemic point of view. I think we as parents and key guardians of young people or even just people in the community who really say you care about your community, we need to first respect ourselves and then we need to start trying to help young people because we can't help young people to heal unless we do our own self-journey. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying we can't contribute, but to really help a young person heal, you really need to be on your own journey as well because a person can feel your vibration and energy too. Because remember, we're energetic beings. So,
of course, most definitely, definitely. And I love the fact that you just brought up Scotland then in terms of the problems. But the reason I'm wanting to bring it back to race, because I want to talk about us, because I can only talk about our community. I'm talking about our community. I'm coming from a black female perspective when I'm talking about what I'm talking about. You're coming from a black male perspective and your book is written from your perspective. Yeah. So coming back to that, because obviously I know I don't want to get into the whole, we can get into it with regards to, yes, there's problems all over the world. There's problems in Scotland, but I want you to use that as a
template of what really we need to do, like reshifting, changing the way we look at things.
Yes.
Because I think in our communities, we have a bigger problem where we do a lot of judging in our communities.
Yes, we do.
Like a lot of judging in our communities. And I think if we rechange the model and stop judging and looking at the, and again, this is society, this is systemic thing that London has where we tend to focus on media aspect where we judge. Everyone does it. America, Scotland, everywhere does it. But Scotland took approach where they just took away the judging of everybody that's doing the violence and the young people and the negativeness and mothers are doing, the fathers are doing, and tried to look at things from say, okay, where are you at and what's going on in your life? And then you deal a person where they're at. Be like Jesus and Lazarus, and Jesus went to the hell to take Lazarus out of hell.
Yeah.
Meet somewhere they're at.
Yeah,
that's a lot we need to do in our community. You mentioned about the black community. I feel like in our community, we need to focus on really how do we not judge so much? Because I grew up seeing my mother struggling. Yeah, at times. And her sister would borrow her money, and I'll be very open when I say this. Her sister borrowed money. Before she borrows her money, she gave her a little lecture, though. I listen, there's a little you in here.
Yeah.
That shit is degrading. Mm. You get me? So it's that is just very degrading. And if we're going to do these things, you got to bear in mind, I ain't going to want to talk to you again and ask you for nothing if you're always going to lecture me when you're telling me about my problems. Do you get what I'm saying to you? Like, we need to, like, when I work with young people, I don't try to belittle them about what they're going through. It's like, okay, how can I meet you where you're at to take you out? Not to, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. Why you do that? No. Or a mother taking money from a child who's doing crime, you know, and then you'll say, well, you should know you shouldn't take money from your child. I hear people who are supposed to be, you know, topping the so-called black community. And, you know, these people are supposed to be like, you know, real esteemed people and highly, I won't call names, but highly motivated, major people. But at the same time, they're missing the bigger picture. And come from a street perspective, I'm saying, if that mother has turned to her loved ones or her cousins or her friends and everybody, and people put her down for the situation she's going through or her poverty, her son's out there doing hustling because he doesn't want to see mum struggle no more. I'm just painting a picture for you. He don't see mum do the struggle no more, and he's already overheard mum getting ducked this by sister or brother or cousin or whatever. He don't respect none of them anyway no more. That's why we have the generational gap going on anyway. Then it's like, mom taking money from him, and you're gonna say, "Well, she's wrong." Maybe she's wrong if you look at it in a box view. But if you look at it holistically, she's going through her own traumas. It's not dealt with. She's got no one to turn to because everyone she's turning to is yak, and disrespecting her, making her feel less than as a mother than what she already in. The son's seeing that and having no respect for the other people around, like the family members, and this is why we have such disfranchised families. Because this is just one scenario I'm giving, but we have many different problems that fit in the scenario.
Yeah.
So what is important is if those who say they really understand, now instead of going and judging, step back and then look at mother and ask mother, how could we help? How could we sort things out? What could we do to ease things, ease the tension for you? Son, what could we do to get you back into something? There needs to be a different approach. I think there's more judges in our community than there is actually victims. Mm-hmm. When really should we all are victims, because everyone's a victim at some point.
Exactly.
We catch them. Yeah. Like me. I did a lot of stuff in my life, but like I talk about my book, there was a point in my life I was a victim. When my stepfather was abusing me as a little boy, okay, I never opened my mouth. I spoke. I was a very introvert. I didn't talk. But it made me wild. But there was a point in my life I was a victim before I became what so-called society would classify as a perpetrator, because I took lives and I did, you know, violent crimes. But I was a victim at one point in time. But who saw me when I was a victim? Or who understood when I was a victim? Do you get what I mean? So it's about looking back the layers, and I think these are important things to do in our society. We need to stop judging or being like, there's a way of explaining somebody when they've done something, when things ain't correct in their life, but it's how do you go about it? Like they say, sweet words turn it off. Do you get what I'm saying to you? Says, how do you
totally? I just see it's listening,
You know what I mean?
No, you're right, and I just see it as what you're saying, really. In terms of wrapping that, to kind of just to understand that from another perspective. Rather than judging, sometimes it's important to listen. That's what I find. Sometimes it's good because everyone's situation is different. And sometimes we just say, tell me about it. Tell me about what you're going through. And when you say, you know what, I don't understand. You know, I understand what I've gone through, but I don't understand. So tell me about it. And you just listen. So that's sometimes really, really, really powerful with young people. And I've experienced that myself. So I think that's lovely that you've picked up on that in terms of, you know, in the work that you do, in terms of trying to understand them rather than judge them. Because as you said, everyone, we all go through stuff. And you're right, some people are at these kind of, you know, top places within society, and people are looking up to them. And one thing I think is really important, actually, this comes from my mother. She taught me, she said, don't look up to anyone. You don't look up to anyone. Do you know what I mean? In terms of in life, because people are people and everybody's got something going on at the end of the day. So you could look at the bin man or you could look at the lawyer. For me, they just had different paths in life. Doesn't mean that lawyer is a better person than that person who maybe picks up your bins. You don't know what they've gone through. You don't know what they've experienced. And that's really always been my way in terms of even with me in this show, whatever I do, you know, if I meet a person, I try to understand them or try to learn about them, because it's so important in that respect. And because then you are respecting that human being, because even on a spiritual level, you know, we're all spirits. We're all spirits having a human experience, yeah? And we've chosen to have an experience in a different way. we've got, and all of our paths are different, and that's how I kind of would describe that. But I want to come back to your book because I want to talk about your experience, really, Healy. That's why I'm coming back. I know you've got some amazing work that you're doing. I think it's brilliant that you're doing, but I want to get to the heart of why you do what you do. Okay, and you did say you went into prison, and I want to hear that story in terms of what you went into prison for, and I want to come out the other side in terms of how you came to be this person who is now doing youth engagement, because I think it's quite a story. So I want to home in on you now, okay? So can you tell me a little bit about why you went to prison and what that experience was for you?
In fact, I'm in prison twice in Jamaica. I'm in prison, I was 15, I'm in prison for drug trafficking. I used to traffic drugs from Jamaica to England. And then I got caught and I'm in prison the first time. I got released because, you know, money talks in Jamaica, and it's like I got out early still. And then I got incarcerated again at the age of 22 in Jamaica. Again, I got released at 15, came back to England. By the age of 16, I had to leave the country. I left the country and went to Jamaica because I couldn't stay in England. I had a very troubled past myself and the police. We were always at it. They were always arresting me for different things, and they could never really prove a lot on me. You know, they said I did an armed robbery at the age of 16, which age of 15, which was it was something I didn't do. That one I didn't do anyway. That specifically I didn't do because my alibi was actually the police. That's the word, alibi. My alibi was the police. So the police came to my house to arrest me for armed robbery, hoping they got me this time, because I already bust a robbery case before with them, and I bust quite a few cases with them, and I bought some ID prayers I beat. But this time, they said I did an armed robbery, but the armed robbery they said I did, I was actually on an ID parade with the police at the same time they did the armed robbery. So technically, the armed robbery happened, but I was in Brixton and Police Station that evening when they said I robbed the shop. I was in an ID parade with the police. So Brixton Police was my alibi. So that kind of crushed South Kilburn. That was Queen's Park Police and West Hampton came for me, like the whole station literally. Because they really wanted me. They really wanted me as a youth. My mum was just fed up and she's like, you know, you just got to leave this country and go to Jamaica and stay. Because I kept going to Jamaica back and forth. I couldn't stay. I was always in problems. I was very tormented as a young person. I had a lot of internal conflicts going on with myself. You know, I was constantly like oil and water. I was constantly fighting myself. This couldn't mix. It's just terrible mix, oil and water. That's how it was me. I was just always, you know, back and forth myself mentally. And so I went to Jamaica 16 to 19. I was in Jamaica. Couldn't make it work. I had to come back to England. Again, a lot of violence out there in Jamaica. I went to Jamaica as an English youth. I did a lot of crazy things, you know, that you wouldn't expect some from England to come and do in Jamaica. You know, but again, that's where my mind was at. And then I, not to go too deep into to glamorize it, but there's only a few things in my book. But then I came back to England. Mom died on me. And because I hadn't seen her since I was 16, so she died.
Wow. You were 16 when your mum passed?
No, I was 19 when she passed.
19. Okay.
Yeah, I was 16 when I went to Jamaica. She sent me to Jamaica. Yeah. Came back when I was 19 because some situations happened. She came for me, went back to England, and she died on me.
Oh,
and then, so she died. She came back to England. She got sick like a week or so later, a week and a half. So stay in a coma for about 3 weeks, a month, and then she died. Mm. And I kind of just did again. I didn't really cry much. I just kind of spiraled out of control and went back to the streets. Mm. You know? And then I was created mayhem, put that way. Did a lot of stuff on the roads, put myself in problems. Had to leave England because of the situation. And I went to Jamaica. Plus I went there for some music as well. I was trying to get off the streets at one time. So I started to you know, grow my locks and deal with the Rasta faith and everything. Then, yeah, it was good. It was a beautiful experience, but the travel pass held on to me, you know? And that's like spiritual latching. I talk about, you mentioned earlier about spirituality, but we also have a thing called spiritual latching that people don't really understand what's going on in the spiritual world. You know, like you can walk past somebody, and if you walk past somebody, all of a sudden you'll just feel down.
Yeah, yeah. Oh God, the energy.
The spiritual latching, they can just latch onto you. We're very spiritual beings, you get me? But, you know, as the Bible says, a man without control of his own spirit is like a city without walls. And if you're a city, if you have a city, it's got no walls, it's easy penetrated, isn't it? It's easy conquered. So really and truly, this time, you know, most youth don't understand how to actually build their own citadel in within themselves. You get me? Mm. Build up your spirit. You get what I'm saying to you? So you can control your own, your own self. So maybe people can't really latch their spirit onto you so easy, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a deep conversation we can get into, but I don't want to go too much into that kind of thing. But yeah, man can get deep on anything. This is the car. We have that insight, that spirituality, you know? But so in time I was young, I didn't really understand about them things. So, you know, negativity latched onto me and I went back out in the streets. And I just got myself involved. Even though I was trying to do Rasta thing, got myself involved with some stuff on the sideline. And, you know, it ended up me going back to, I had to leave it to go do music in Jamaica. I wanted to do Jamaican music in Jamaica, but I had to leave because my name was called up on something. And I had a feeling that, you know, if things are going to get out of control. So I ended up going to Jamaica and my past caught back up on me. Me and some guys I had a problem with in Jamaica. We had a situation and some guy I don't know got involved with them. Some of their friends got involved and a guy lost his life, you know. Yeah. I ended up taking his life and I got away from the scene and I could have come back to the UK, but for some reason why I went back there to the scene. I know it was one of the most I guided me back still. It sounds as crazy as it sounds. I believe the most I got me back because I had a lot of things going on in my life anyway.
Mm.
And when I went to prison, a lot of my friends died. A lot of my friends went to prison.
Wow.
Most of my close friends are doing 40 years, you know, in Jamaica, some are doing 200-300 years. You get me? A lot of my friends are dead over here and in Jamaica, where I grew up in South Kilburn. A lot of my friends are dead. You know, all about at least 7-8 man. I'll tell you, I think about 15 miles together around close to my area that I grew up in originally, and I passed away. You know, so I know that something would have happened to me if I was still on road because I was kind of like in the midst of a lot, but at the same time, silently doing a lot. You get me? So
can I ask you then what, because it's interesting. Number one, I'm curious about, I can ask you in a minute, but the difference between being in prison in JA to being in prison over here. But what I'm more curious about is...
I've never been in prison in UK.
Only UK.
I've never been in prison in UK.
Oh, you haven't? So it's only Jamaica. So you haven't got a difference. But what I'm more curious about is that away.
There's a big difference.
I want to know what you're awakening, because I love that. I want to, because you know, in terms of all of your friends, like you said, it sounds to me like just from the way you're talking,
it's
the
same
friends,
like
family.
Like family. We grew together and we love each other. Even though we're all doing wrong things. Yeah. We all had our own traumas. You know, none of my friends just took the road thing for the fun of it. We all had traumas.
Yeah.
Especially grew up in Jamaica, places like Kingston. Like, I had friends from Jungle and different places and from Jewsland and places, you know, and from out east. We had our own traumas. Poverty was a big problem to a lot of us. Yeah. So we saw parents crying over money. We grew up without no father. You get me? So everyone had their own traumas going on. Mm. And we became each other's just friends, innit? Like, have a confidence and we could look at each other and love each other and trust each other. So, of course, we stood for each other, innit?
Yeah.
You get me? Even in the wrongs that we were doing, we stood for each other. And even though that, in my mature mindset, I see it as misplaced loyalty, because sometimes your friend will do something or even I may do something and it doesn't deserve, or it doesn't entail us to do or react the way we react. But again, society hasn't dealt to us to do with our emotions. Back to that again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I say that, I'm saying that within, from schools to school to within the home, you're not really taught about doing emotions. You get me? So when my, if I say, for instance, if your friend was to have a little problem, you know, it's that pride of your friend says, well, this man violated me. You're not really going to ask why or who, you know, you're going to defend your friend because that's just your friend. You get me? You're young and that's how you look at it. Some people may say that's naive and, you know, but it's not really naive. You have to look at where people's minds are at and how close or how connected are they to the individual. It's like a mother saying, I'm not going to see somebody hit my son.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You look at that same, you look at that man on the street, like he's like, not like a son, he's closer than a son to you. Because he's like a lifeline for you. That's where your mind's at. You get me? So it's misplaced loyalty, because again, at the same time, some things that people do, like I saw my book, I got booed out of school for £1. Yeah. One of my friends stole a £1 of a boy. Well, a few pounds, one of my schools. He stole a few pounds of a boy. And we beat this boy and his brother to there was like, literally battered them.
Wow.
But the thing is, if we was, the mindset I was in today, like I wrote my book, because I call it self-reflective analysis of my life. When we was younger, my friends took some money from a guy, one of his classmates, but we thought he was borrowing money. But he stole the money, he took the money from him, bad him up, took the money, came back to us, and we continued playing pound the wall at school. Now, if in my mature mindset where I'm at today, I would have said to the guy and the guy's brother came over and was angry at my friend for doing what he done, took his brother's money. I would have come over and I would have literally then said, in my mindset today, I'd be like, bro, sorry, you took your brother's money. Here's some money back. We all had money. Then time was hustling a little weed. So I would have given back a £10 note and, you know, even a spliff and say, yeah, take that, go. Do you get me? But in our ego, when you came over and started getting angry at my friend for taking your brother's money, we're like, you're disrespecting our link. Do you get what I'm saying to you? That's misplaced loyalty, because some of us, we will defend each other's wrongs and not realize that we can actually make things right. Like, I got booed out of school for £1. One single pound. If I had the right mindset back then, I could have replaced back the couple pounds that my friend took from the guy, like I said, and give him a spliff and, you know, it's over, realistically. Mm. But we didn't. We saw it as a disrespect, your big brother coming to, you know, talk down on my friend. Do you get what I'm saying to you?
Yeah.
So misplaced loyalty, I mean, we find that happens even with parents. A child might do something and, you know, it's again, like, it's all about with the minds that, you know what I'm saying to you? Like, our mind was in a very, in this state of mind, I would say in a very troubled way. We were very troubled. Yeah. But then socially, we had we've seen a lot. Like I said, we've seen a lot. We've seen a lot and we've been through a lot. And I feel sorry for the kids today, because it's worse for them, because there's so much music portraying violence more than back in the days. There's so much, you know, games, Grand Theft Auto, all these kind of games that portray violence. I mean, like, we're desensitizing ourselves from violence so much in so many different ways. So everyone now is filming violence on the streets and sending it around on WhatsApp. So it becomes like a norm and it becomes like a fun thing and everyone's kind of just cool with it. You know, society needs, we as a people, we got a lot of work to do on ourselves in regards to changing the way we psychologically look at things and deal with things. But like I said, for me, it's never about judging. It's about really educating people to understand the pitfalls that before them, because there's a lot of pitfalls that before us that are set for us in regards to, like I said, the hype, the over sexuality in music and the violence in music. And, you know, I remember we got, bear in mind, these are big organizations that are funding young people to sing these things. And if you're not singing certain type of songs, you're not getting signed, right?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's interesting. I do agree with you on that note, so in terms of social
grooming. There's a level of social grooming going on.
Yes, most definitely.
So they talk about gang grooming. They talk about young people they talk about guys on the streets grooming young kids and sending them to country, what they call county lines, which don't make much sense, that whole terminology. Mm. But when you look at it, you've got systematic grooming going on.
Yeah, yeah.
You get at a bigger scale. You're grooming young kids through music. You're grooming young kids through media. You're grooming. You're showing that you got to have certain bling. You got to have certain this. It's never about, like I said, it's never about aligning yourself and centralize yourself, or, you know, understanding you're the true master of your own destiny. It's not about that. It's about external glory and external joy. You get me? So
you're right.
There's a lot that needs to be addressed and dealt with, you get me? And it's not going to be easy, but yeah, it's something that, you know, I'm willing to, you know, put my time into, help young people to really understand the pitfalls that are there for them, physically, mentally, and spiritually.
I think that's amazing, because I think you're so right there in terms of, you know, you have some people, like some record companies, they are glamorizing ghetto, they're glamorizing this kind of gangster lifestyle in some ways, and signing these young people that are singing some stuff that is just, you know what I mean, glamorizing that sort of way. And like you say, all this over sexualizing, and there's some horrible stuff that's out there. And I think, I mean, I'm used to being into hip-hop back in the day, and the hip-hop used to be a voice where we used to speak about, you know, our troubles and what's going on in it. And, you know, it was a way that you can be almost an activist. But I think what's happened now, and I know you've still got some people doing that amazing work within grime and stuff, but then now you've got some people that are glamorizing gangster lifestyle, glamorizing, you know, negativity.
I mean, it's got to be a problem now, because you look at hip hop back then.
Sorry, I don't know. Go ahead.
You said just even just now. I'm referring to now. If you look back into hip hop, even back in the, when you look at hip hop going back to, you know, KRS-One, BDP, hip hop was always about consciousness, you know, fight power, public enemy. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, you had the 5%ers, you had the Nation of Islam, you had the, you know, the Black Power movement. But at the same time, you had Interscope and other big organizations pushing money, and then you had the gangster rap came out back in the 70s. I mean, back in the 80s, I mean, the gangster rap in the 80s come out. So, you know, you had the Ice-T, Colors, I Am a Night, Nightmare Walking, Psychopath Talking. Then you had the whole movie actually came out, Colors, you know, with the whole violence. So when you look on it, systematic grooming, that's why I call it programming. That's why I say programs. We do watch programs. Back to us about TV programming. Mm. It was programmed for a long time ago. Do you get what I mean? And when I look at my first friend who died at age of 11, he died because of graffiti. You get what I'm saying to you?
Wow.
So, and I was 11, he was 11, because I think we were the same age. You get me?
It's blown up even more so now.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about. Social media makes it look like it's gone to another scale.
Because I talk about again in my book, why it's more destructive for young people, because they created what they call the World Wide Web.
Mm.
The World Wide Web is a trauma feeder. As much as it's allowed us to do what we're doing now, it can be used for positive, as we're talking today about positivity. But we got to think about the mechanism, the master mechanism of this system. It pushes so much negativity, there's so much information. Half the information pushed out, even about history, isn't correct. Because even in regards to, like, it pushed so much history about, even what we call, what we say is Black history. But some things it pushes doesn't necessarily resonate to us or isn't about us, because we, again, in prison, I learned to really accept myself in regards to my culture and where I came from, my mom's history, where that was something I never really took on as a little youth, because I grew up knowing I was an Israelite. But I didn't, because my mom's name is Juanita Bathsheba Shamuel. She was born that. You know, my family mixed in Jamaican and Syrian. I didn't see myself as, like, to me, my granddad was a Black Jew when I was young. That was like, what's that? I don't want to hear about that, because no one says that. Everyone know about Rastafarian and Christian and Muslim, and everything. I didn't know about nothing else. So that was like, I don't want to hear about all that stuff. As soon as I was in prison, I sat down and really realized that I had an identification. I had an identity. I didn't just have a color, because again, that's a systematic construct as well. They give us a color and not actually a culture.
Mm.
Color isn't a culure. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
We've been given a color, just like how they cut up Africa give Africa, rename Africa. They've renamed us with a color and not a culture.
Yes, most definitely.
A color, not a culture. And something we have to get out of that as well. We have to get out of that construct, because that construct actually really goes nowhere. Do you get what I'm saying to you? And it started off, and it done good for us and great to Marcus Garvey and others that brought us, give us love, to love our skin.
Yeah.
But we're real on our skin. We actually have, we have ancestral blood that runs through our veins. And to wake your ancestors up, you have to identify ancestors. I can't wake an ancestor I don't identify with, because my ancestor will not be happy. Does that make sense?
You're talking on a different level there.
When you go to Nigeria, I travel a lot, I make documentary, I travel a lot. When you go to Nigeria, you see the Igbo, the Yoruba, everywhere. You go to South Africa, I go to South Africa, I see the same thing. I've been to Nigeria, but I've made Nigerian friends. Yeah. And then I've been to Africa, I see things in Africa, the Hicks and different tribes. Now I've been in these places. Now I go to Palestine to see the black Palestinians. They know their tribes and the Tel Abin, the Hirati, the Azazma tribe. They know when they're chanting or they're praying or they're meditating, they're waking that. Remember, your ancestors never far from you, they're in your blood.
Yeah, that's it.
Live in your blood.
Mm.
Your blood carries your DNA. Best, they try to swap DNA, the best DNA is in your blood.
Yeah.
That's your answer. That's why, as in culturally, we never eat if you're eating meat. You never eat the blood. You always pour the blood to the earth, because the blood's the life of the body. Because you can be brain dead, but if your heart's still beating, you're technically alive. But when your brain can be gone, but if your heart's gone, you're gone. Because the blood is the life of your body. It's a no-brainer. So the reality is, in your blood, if you know, live the ancestors. So for me personally, it's like, to awaken my ancestors, we don't awaken my ancestors, and I'm really chatting, I have to know my ancestors, know who they are. I can't just say, it's okay, I can say ancestors wake, I need you, and they can feel you, they can hear. But when you're calling them in a name or in a reference that they know, like this is who we were, or you know, I'm Igbo, my Igbo ancestors strengthen me. You understand? You're really cool.
Totally.
My ear where you're my guy or my blah blah blah. You get what I mean? So, I mean, I call them my ancestors because I know now. I know my history. Before I had prison, this is why I said prison was the best thing for me. If I don't go to prison, I wouldn't have known, I wouldn't have really accepted my history and my culture.
It's interesting that you said that. I want to just home into that, because it's almost, I asked you earlier if you could tell me about your awakening. And I think you've just mentioned that in terms of saying prison was the best thing for you, because it's almost like when you go for an awakening, it's when you pause, when you stop. And I suppose you went to prison, you were doing, you know, you're doing all those negative things. But then when you paused energetically and you stopped, you started to discover yourself and who you are. Like you said, you started to discover your like where you're coming from and your ancestors, and you probably needed was reading more. And I think that's really powerful. You know, I always think, you know, I'm a lover of Malcolm X. Who doesn't love Malcolm X? You know what I mean? As a conscious woman. And I think the same thing happened for Malcolm X. You know, Malcolm, because he got into Islam, didn't he, when he paused. But it's really interesting that I'm saying this, but I feel it's probably true. Look, you said prison was the best thing for you and you paused.
As you can see that, this chapter says slow down. Mm. This chapter, you call slow down. It's technically what I've done. I realized in prison, if I was on road, we live in society, it's very fast. Mm. It's very fast going, whether we know it or not. You get a job, rush to work, rush to this, rush to that, rush to this. Very fast going. And if you're not rushing nothing, they brainwash you to believe you got to sit in front of TV, you got to sit in front of this. We never, like I said, emotional control and emotional intelligence are something we're not taught about.
Yeah,
emotional intelligence is so important. If we just take a moment to sit down, and I'm not saying people need to go to prison like me. And
you could do meditation.
But I took prison was my time to feel like I said, I just felt like I had to get caught, I had to be arrested. Yeah, like when I really forced myself, why did I go back to the scene? I got away, why did I go back to the scene? But it's like I just needed to be arrested, I need to go to prison, because that gave me time to reflect. I reflected, and when I started reflecting, I picked up the Bible, started reading, I started seeing life for myself. I let go all preconceived ideas that I've heard about scriptures, because like I said, remember I was going to Rastafarian movement, but my mom was an Israelite. Mm. And she grew up telling us that's what we was. You know, she wasn't fully practicing, but she grew up telling us this is what we were. And we said we were black Jews. And so, but it was like, whatever. And my granddad would say the same thing, because he's also, he was a black Jew. But to me, that would have meant nothing. But when I had time to sit down in prison, reflect on myself and really check myself and check my who I am, I started to really assess certain situations and certain things that was going on in my life. And it made me, it actually brought out the best of me, because I realized that instead of me just moving so fast, like a society program has to move, just slow down. And I realized that in a spiritual world, I can move much faster. Because when you're physically moving so fast, you can't actually, it's actually really moving slow. In a spiritual world, you're not moving properly. You're not moving at you're moving at someone else's rhythm. Someone else's rhythm. They are someone else's beat. But I had time to actually sit down and slow my physical self down, and spiritually, I started moving. And then I realized that I wasn't really, I realized that people on road were more trapped than me though I'm in prison. Because they might physically cage me, but my spirit and my mind was not caged. I was able to see things and do things. I taught myself to read Hebrew in prison. I had a lot of problems in prison, a lot of fights, a lot of everything. At one time, I was stabbed in prison, cut my chest, stabbed. I went through a lot of violence in prison. There's a lot of violence happening in prison, a lot of things that I can't really go into do ideas about, but, you know, a lot of stuff happened in prison.
So in your book, you talk about in your books.
Yeah, I talk about something. Some of these violence that I talk about in my book, yeah, definitely. Mm. But it's like, when I learned to love myself, I realized that I won a lot of people over, like enemies, friends. I changed my dynamics, my energy. We can change. We have the power to change our energy. Remember, we're created as whether someone's religious and they believe in Abrahamic faith or not. Everyone, if you believe in Kemet, no matter what you believe in, everything's, you know, the Akkadian tablets, Sumerian tablets. I mean, everyone teaches that the Most High created man from the dust, from the earth. Every philosophy teaches that, pygmy, whatever. And the reality is, if you're created from the earth, you have connection to the soil.
Yes.
You're created to soil, and you're created to soil mineralogy. You're created to soil mineralogy, you're created to the essence of, you're not just a mineral, but the carbon, you're created to the atmosphere, the things in the atmosphere, the energy of the atmosphere. Then you can actually change the way things are moving in the atmosphere for you too.
Yes.
Because you're connected to it. Why can't you? You have a relation to it. But then if you're sleeping, you're dead, and you're too busy walking around in a speeded system, then again, like I said, you're moving very slow. You're moving spiritually slow, but you're moving faster system because you're not connected to what you need to be connected to. So you're not going to change the dynamics of your life and the priority of things that needs to happen. So I had the moment to sit down in prison and realize who I was, which then allowed me to change the way I was looking at life and where I saw things. And then I started to shift other people's energies shift my energy that other people naturally would shift their energies to deal with me. Does that make sense?
I'm not
dictated or controlled, but I learned how to channel myself that when I brought my injury to the forefront when I was talking to people. They couldn't come down to me. I know they actually raised themselves up to reason with me on a different level. That makes sense. So I kind of like, I had the ability to carry myself and conduct myself in a way where people who hate each other in prison or people who were big time killers in prison. I talk about my book. They were, and I mean the real names in my book. They were cool with me. I would break this problem up and I would talk to this person. And people were like, I went in one way and I left the prison as like a really known guy. Like really known. Not because I was bad or, I had to defend myself in prison, but really because my insight, my knowledge, the way I transfer my energy. It's like today, I work with youths in my area where I live in Harlesden, Church Road, but I also deal with Stormwood youths. I deal with Kilburn youths. Most people won't do that. They won't go in different areas, but I go in every area. You get me? If you go on my Instagram, you see different people from different areas support my book. Because I don't bow myself to the illusion of society, but I bow myself to the spirit of truth.
Exactly. And when you've got that energy, there's no fear because you believe in the power of your energy as well.
You don't even need to even feel for about a fear factor. It's more of a fact of you're projecting that you're using a certain degree of love that people, whether they're on some negative or whatever, they can feel you're not on what they're on. And they know that you're not to come at you with whatever they're doing would just be silly. It wouldn't even make no sense.
Yeah,
no, you get me? That doesn't make no sense because they can feel you're just on a different mission. So that's really me in it. Like, for me, I don't even worry about fear or being brave. It just is. It just is. Like, no, I'm just on a path.
Yeah.
So I'm not even worried about fear. I'm not even worried about being brave. I'm just on a path.
Yes.
And I'm just sighted on my path. That means that anything coming my way, you're coming into my path.
I get that. I was just explaining it in terms of that. I mean, when you've got no fear, it's because you don't believe in fear. When you say I have no fear, it's because you don't believe in it. Yeah. But you're so right in terms of, I love what you're saying in terms of when you are on your path and your path is love, the energy of love is on a very high vibration. Yeah. So that means that, as you said, you can talk to anyone, you can communicate and love. You're not just saying it. You're believing it because you have that self-worth, and it is an energy that's able you to manifest something better for yourself. And I think that's something very, very spiritual in terms of, like you say, going through being able to meditate or being able to connect or reflect, however way you're going to do it. When you're on that love energy, it's a different vibrational energy, and it's not superficial. It's something that's real. And people pick it up. I think people pick it up in terms of connecting. And I think that's beautiful that you'll go to the different postcodes. Because otherwise, if you're the people that aren't going to different postcodes, they're operating from fear. So that means that they're not there. And when you're operating from fear, that isn't love energy, do you know? You've got to work through that fear to get to it. But there's nothing wrong with it, but it just means that you've probably got a little bit more work to do to work through that. To get to that point, you say, I've got no fear. I have no fear, as they say, I have no fear. And you connect on that level. But, I'm going to have to bring it to a close now. There's so much there. And you know what? I feel like people that are listening right now will probably go out and buy your book because there is so much there that's unsaid in this podcast as well with regards to, we've talked about a lot of things, but I think a lot of people probably be wanting to know a little bit more about what you went through in prison. And I do love the fact that you shared with me that moment of calm and that moment of prison actually being the best thing for you. Not saying put everyone in prison, but we'd like you to say the only way it was to control your energy was to stop. And I think energetically, if you think from a spiritual perspective, energetically, they said, this has got to stop. And it's either you die or you're going to continue on a better path. So energetically, the universe, God, or whatever your belief system is, stopped you. And that was done through prison. You could say that. You could say that on
some level. Like I said, physically, a lot of people running around fast and they're spiritually not really moving.
Mm.
But I understand that even stillness is movement.
Yeah.
You get me? So I was still and then everything just started moving different for me. So I encourage people all the time. I do that with young people. I tell them, meditation is important. Like, meditation, man, all the time. I say, meditation and visualization are two important things to do. Meditation and visualization are not to be seen. A lot of people believe that they are the same, but they're actually not the same.
Yes, that's very true.
Because are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
It's important that we understand both those transformational skills,
That's true. And I said that she's so funny. Actually, just made me think of something with regards to someone said to me, someone said to her, I can't. It was a young person that I can't do. So I said to them, you know what? if an athlete, if Usain Bolt said, I can't finish the 100 metres, you know, he wouldn't have done the 100 metres. So we've got to let go of that can't or that self-belief, because athletes visualise winning, yeah? And it's the same with us. If we visualise winning or being successful or visualising what we want and then believe in it and meditate on it, it's amazing how powerful energetically things can change just by not just reaching for it, but believing it. Because some people say, I want to do this, I want to do that. And it's all taught, but you've got to believe it inside of yourself, haven't you, to get to that point. So I think that's really, really, really powerful. And it sounds like you're on that journey and you've done that work and you're connected with young people. So it's brilliant.
I've came from doing nothing, from not having no qualification to now having a degree in medicine. I also do, like, I've made 19 documentaries, brilliant. Two short movies, animated cartoon movie. I've wrote 4 books, you know, I do mentoring. It's all self-funded. Without no illegal money, no ill gain. The point is, it's not like I've got loads of money at all. It's not that at all. Because I invest my own money back in the community. And most of my documentaries are on YouTube for free anyway. But it's about shedding knowledge and information with people, you know. But it's just showing people that, you know, we can do whatever we desire if we put our minds to it.
Most definitely.
People can put no glass ceiling above my head. You get me?
No,
I will achieve what I can achieve.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Well, I'm going to bring it to a close now, Stephen, and we can put some of those links. I'd love to put the links to your YouTube and all. We'll put the links in the podcast as well, so people can connect with you. And we'll put a link to your book on Amazon, so people can buy the book and just learn a little bit more about what you do. And if they want to reach out, they can reach out. So we'll put all those links within the podcast, you know. So lovely talking to you today, and thank you for sharing your story. And I wish you all the best, everything you're doing, and it sounds like you're doing amazing work. And I love that you are, you know, we need more people out like you out there doing that work that you're doing, you know, and doing it where they're not afraid and reaching out and, like, just stepping back and being able to listen to others as well and listen, connect with young people. So we can kind of change their mindset, which can probably prevent them from going to prison if they have that moment of pause. I mean, if we've got more young people stopping and thinking and reflecting what they're doing before they do it, that will stop crime. Simple as that, you know? So I think that's really, really, really powerful. But anyway, so I'm going to say, from Tani Communication Doctor and from Stephen Graham, thanks for listening and adios. One of my takeaways from this show is looking back and seeing Stephen's journey from having this love of football as a child to coming to a point where he's dealing with internal conflict inside, back and forth as a teenager, to the point of him, you know, having to go into prison and experience what he experienced when he was in JA in the prison, to coming out the other side because he had that moment of calm and that moment of pause whilst he was in prison. And I feel that was his awakening when he was in prison. And going from that to then coming out and positively wanting and going out of his way to help and mentor young people and to get into youth engagement and really try and help people to get in this degree that he has now in medicine. And now this love of connecting people and helping young people. I just think that's an amazing journey, and I would urge you, after listening to his podcast, to purchase his book, Incarceration, because there is just such a powerful message there, which I think a lot of us as human beings, as people, can just try to understand other human beings, to help other human beings and to help our younger generations to grow in more of a positive way, with a positive vibe. Thank you so much for listening. Take care.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. And to listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe.